Right, look, this week and the next. We are going to deal with vaccination, what the logic of vaccination is, and also about the ethical problems connected with compulsory vaccination, whether it should be introduced or it shouldn't, and if it shouldn't, right, what special role should religious objections play? I mean, the contrast here is that first there are medical exemptions, right? Then there are religious exemptions, and separate from religious exemptions, there are so-called personal philosophical exemptions. The numbers are a bit murky. All states in the U.S. technically require vaccination, and it pretty much is required everywhere in the world that has representative democratic governments. Every now and then, a country like Italy decides to go crazy for a few months and make vaccination non-mandatory. That happened about 2 years ago. And then there are a lot of different cases, right, of a particular infectious vaccine-controllable disease that arise, and then they step back and make it compulsory right away. Now, look, the history, as probably all of you know, goes a long way back. There is evidence that the fact that you can inoculate against smallpox was recognized several thousand years ago in both China and India, in particular by taking the scabs of the pox, right, the sores that smallpox victims had, and exposing, right, the healthy people to them. What effectively they're going to be exposed to is the dead, non-reproductive form of the virus, and that's going to generate vaccination. The biological theory of vaccination is actually quite straightforward, and it has only been understood since about the 1950s. So if you look at yourself, the story goes, there are lots and lots of stories that are told about human beings, which I hope by and large you've realized from the Gilbert book is complete mythology. One of the big mythologies is that all cells in your body, right, have exactly the same genes, except for the cells in your gonads and ova, your reproductive cells. Every other cell is supposed to be genetically the same. Well, not true. Your immune cells are quite different, and inside your body, you have a very large diversity of what are called B cells. These are a type of white blood cell, and they're central to your immune system. Everybody with me? Okay? So when you are in an environment, there are lots and lots of pathogens around, right, which you are most of the time, your most important line of defense is your skin. We've talked about this many times, and that's why with burn victims, the crucial thing is to prevent infection, often by keeping them on a regimen of very high doses of antibiotics and in as sterile an environment as possible. But if your these pathogens manage to penetrate the skin and get inside your body, then the B cells are supposed to recognize parts of this pathogen and generate an immune system and more or less deal with that, right? And the immune system is remarkably competent at doing so, and as you probably know, you rarely get sick from infectious agents anymore. So how does all this happen? So inside, just when you are in a stage of a few score cells, you have certain cells that are eventually going to be in your bone marrow and produce your white blood cells. Everybody with me? Okay? And what happens then is that a set of genes, right, These are non-coding areas, sets of genes that will be often represented in this way. These different genes over here, they're going to get recombined in a wide variety of ways, which can all produce different kinds of immunoglobulins. These are proteins inside your body that, as I'll explain shortly, are designed to deal with invading material, right, of this sort. And in fact, you are going to have roughly 10 to the 7 to 10 to the 8, at least that many different kinds of B cells and therefore of immunoglobulins. Everybody with me? How many of you have seen this before? Basically something about the immune system, most of you have. I'm simplifying things a bit, but I don't want to simplify them too much. This is sometimes called the completeness of the immune repertoire. Virtually anything that enters into your body is recognized by these cells and generate an immune response to control them. What do I mean by immune response? Lots and lots of cells and molecules are generated that can destroy this material, and that's what you see when you have pus formation and things of this sort. Everybody with me? Sometimes this thing goes a little awry, that's when you suffer from allergy. An allergy is essentially an immune response where a pollen or something like that that's not really harmful to you generates the immune response, and you get in all kinds of circumstances. Everybody with me? So how does this happen? Well, so you have all these different kinds of antibodies, right? These antibodies are proteins which have a particular receptor, all right? And when a foreign element comes, so this is an antibody, and that's the receptor of it. When a foreign pathogen comes in to the body, there are dedicated cells and molecules in them that cut them up in small parts for what's called presentation. Okay. These small cut parts are called antigen. Okay. So antigens, a bunch of multiple antigens, are generated by the same pathogen that comes in as they're cut up into small pieces. Everybody with me? Any questions so far? Okay. Now, because there is such a wide variety of antibodies inside your body, some antibody or the other recognizes the antigen properly. What do I mean by recognizing the antigen properly? There is a lock and key fit between the shapes. They grasp the shapes completely. This is an idea you have encountered before back when we were dealing with the genetics and reductionism book. It's a standard way in which molecular biology operates. These are the subtle interactions by which the shape of one molecule fits into the shape of another molecule. If it's a substrate, it fits into the enzyme, and the enzyme pulls apart, breaks the substrate, and generates energy and material that the body needs. Everybody with me? Okay. Now, not only do these antibodies float around inside the circulatory system in your blood, every one of the B cells has a particular antibody attached to it. Everybody with me? So here you are, you're a B cell, you have an antibody attached to it, it recognizes an antigen. What does it do? It begins multiplying like anything, okay? Really, really rapidly. So you get millions of copies of that B cell, right? And they all then go and grasp anything that has that antigen, so all the invading material, and essentially just smash them up. And then ultimately through pus and stuff like that, it gets separated, sent out of the body. Everybody with me? So the crucial part here was doing all the defending, right? Is going to be the presence of the B cells. If you don't have enough of a B cell that can respond to a particular antigen, the corresponding pathogen, which is quite rare, can proliferate in your body. Are you with me? All right, so what do? So how do you acquire natural immunity? If you're like me, well, if you're not, I'm a lot older than you, but lots of people, even in this country in my age, will have had childhood measles. What does it mean? We get exposed to the measles virus, and as you can see in my case, the measles virus failed to kill me. I'm still alive. What that means is my immune response managed to generate, or happen to have, the particular B cells that could serve as an antigen for the measles virus, right? And lots of these B cells were generated. That process of multiplication of B cells is called clonal selection, a clone of them. Every one of those cells is the same. Those were generated and all of that. The measles, I recovered from measles, but a fair number of those, that particular kind of cell keeps on reproducing and hangs around in my body, and so I'm unlikely, very unlikely, to get measles again. Everybody with me? Okay. If I had survived smallpox, which fortunately had disappeared even by when I was a child, okay, I would have immunity to smallpox. Everybody with me? So now what do you do? What you do is, by any trick available to you, create the antigen corresponding to a pathogen. Okay? You can take one way of doing it. A pathogen happens to be a cell, right? I'm talking of whooping cough now. That's coming back, right? So I take the cell and kill it. It's still the full cell, but it's dead, right? And I inject that into you. I, so to say, covered myself in the sense that since that cell has been killed, it cannot grow in you, right? Everybody with me? But it will generate an immune response, and then, because of what's called immune memory, the corresponding B cells will linger on in your body for years and years and years, and so you won't get pertussis, which is a technical name for whooping cough. Everybody with me? Okay. Eventually, they may decay to some extent in some cases, so you get booster doses. All of you need to get booster doses of TADP, right? Once every 10 years. If you work, as I work for a long time, and this is not pleasant, if you're at risk for rabies, you have to go every couple of years and get 3 different shots of those antigens provided into you. That's what the vaccines are. That's how vaccination works. Everybody with me? Okay. If it's the case of measles, you should get the first of these injected in you at about 1 year of age, right? And a booster dose at about 4 years of age. And then pretty much you're safe for the next 40, 50 years. If there's any reason to suspect you're not completely safe, you might get another booster dose at that point. Are you with me? Okay. So that's how vaccination works, and that's what it's supposed to do. Now, I intentionally used the example of pertussis, right? So here, originally, the vaccine for it just were killed whole cells, right? And of course, as in any, right, kind of technological procedure, sometimes the cells were not fully killed. And what happened? You injected somebody with that vaccine and the person got whooping cough. If they survived, of course, they'd be immune all the time, but they got sick because they got injected with the disease-producing agent itself, right? So about 20 years ago, instead of cells, right, you just broke the cells apart and you made it acellular, made sure that the thing could not survive and reproduce, and you added safety to it. Everybody with me? One consequence of that has been that the vaccine is no longer as effective. How do you understand that? The whole cell comes in, there's a bunch of different shapes to which antibodies could latch onto. So there is a far, far more diverse and accepting antigenic profile. If you cut it off and only give one part, you can only latch onto that. So the response, the natural immune response inside the body is not quite that powerful and not as long-lasting. And that's why pertussis is, along with the anti-vaccination movement, is making a comeback now. There's a trade-off here. The older vaccines were more effective, but also potentially more dangerous, because every now and then, once every roughly 40,000 cases, somebody would actually get the disease instead of just being vaccinated against it. And we, like most societies, don't think that kind of risk is worth it, right? Okay. So we went to the acellular one, but this probably means that from shortly from now, that TADP, right, or TDAP, whichever version you take it, acellular pertussis will be separated out, and there'll be a different vaccine that for type for. Oh, I better not try to sit on this one; it's broken. That for tetanus, you still will only have to take booster doses every 10 years. But probably for the pertussis, if we want to keep and maintain control on it, you might have to go back and start taking it every 5 years. Everybody with me? That argument has not been settled yet. Experiments have to be carried out to figure out what the right schedule is. All right. Everybody understand the principle of vaccination? What exactly happens? So you take something that corresponds to the antigen to the path. Got the antigen of the pathogen, you inject the body with it in order to generate your natural immune response. Because of immune memory, part of this response sticks around for a long time, and one consequence of that is as long as it sticks around, you are safe from that particular pathogen. Everybody with me? All right, that's what vaccination is. As all of you in this room know, that there is a fair amount of controversy over it. At one end, I want to deal with the medical issues of the controversy, and those are relatively easily dealt with. On the other end, I want to talk a bit about risk and why. I personally do not think that the controversy is completely crazy. It's well justified that there has been a controversy over vaccines in this country. Nevertheless, we want to go into why vaccines need to be introduced and all of that, and how can we do it best. And then a lot of the class is going to be spent with is the ethics of the situation. Clearly, there's a problem here at a variety of levels, including a demand on the basis of societal considerations that somebody stick some potentially slightly dangerous thing inside your body. Everybody with me? I mean, none of you should, I hope, feel absolutely comfortable with the idea that other people or society demands that somebody sticks a needle in your body and injects something into you. I think it's natural to feel some hesitancy about that and worry about just essentially about individual autonomy. Why should this happen? Everybody with me? Okay. All right. Let's start out. And first of all, in order to motivate this, I want to go through a little bit more. Now, so far I've been dealing with the molecular biology and the developmental immunology of vaccination. What then is the epidemiology? Why is vaccination important? And in particular, okay, why any single individual's choice not to vaccinate might hurt other people. Everybody with me? So let's do that part of the science. And I want to get through, if I can, and I probably can, right? We go on to 250, I can get to the entire science today, and we can turn immediately to some of the more, from the point of view of this class, some of the more pertinent normative questions starting on Thursday? Today's Tuesday, right? Yeah. Okay. All right. So, why vaccinate. Now that you know vaccination is understood, why vaccinate for yourself and your choice. Of course, you understand this. Sometimes you decide to do it. Sometimes you decide not to do it. Okay. And by and large, I can. The sort of arguments you have for doing it and not doing it are relatively straightforward. So take one case where people can decide very, 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 very rationally one way or the other of doing it or not doing it. The flu vaccine. Classic case of a vaccine that comes around every year. Should you get yourself vaccinated? Okay. Until I had children, I never did. My argument there was is that it always, you know, irritated me for a day or two. There's always having a, so in my case, I thought, I've always argued that having more vaccine available for others who really think they need it is better than my using up some flu vaccine, and I was unlikely to get it. And the vaccine was so, more often than not, so completely ineffective, right, that it seems to me my cost-benefit analysis told me that I was willing to risk getting the flu rather than having the vaccine. I just would be careful if I suddenly got you know, aches in my body and fever and certain symptoms at the time. I'll be very careful. And so in about 35 years, when I could easily have gotten the vaccine, and I never did, I got the flu once. Okay, I thought that was a reasonable, completely reasonable cost-benefit analysis and all of it. And since I've had daughters, I'd go and get vaccinated again, but I still got it once. The vaccine is not completely effective. It underscored to me that I'm willing to do a fair amount because of others, but it might be a completely rational decision not to get the vaccine. Everybody with me? I'm not telling you to make that decision over here. I'm giving you my reasoning. Okay? At the other end, lots of you might easily feel it costs nothing. It really, you know, you don't, you like, you're the kind of life person who likes lots of needles shot into you all the time. Hell, that's by yourself. You do it to yourself all the time. In that case, you should go and get the vaccine. And if your experience has been that the vaccine never even gives you aches or pains or anything like that, your cost-benefit calculation can be completely different. Everybody with me? Or you might decide you're somebody who gets a cold very easily, so you happen to be particularly susceptible to this kind of virus, you probably should decide to go and get the vaccine, but that's the kind of decision, okay? When does it become important, right, to actually vaccinate yourself, even if you personally don't particularly feel like it or feel at risk? What's the theory behind that? Let's start out with you. That's you, okay? Right? And I'm going to start out with one number called R0. Okay. Why it's called R0 is somewhere out there in history, even I've forgotten why it's called R0. I've been calling it R0 for the last 20 years. There must have been. I'm going to look up what the reason for R0 is. Somebody asked me that this morning, and I simply had forgotten. R0 is the number of people you're likely to be in infective contact for a disease. What do you mean by infective contact? The type of contact that could lead to the disease being spread. Everybody with me? So if you're dealing with tuberculosis, R0 is very high. If I manage to have come into class with the tuberculosis bacterium, by now every one of you would have been exposed to it, right? And if I went through this for a matter of a few days, right, that I was actually infected, I probably would have infected 100 people or so. Some people at the back there probably would be not very likely to have the bacterium go all the way through the air, just directly through me. Those of you who are in the front would have been exposed immediately. Everybody with me? These airborne pathogens are the ones you have to worry about most. Okay. If I had measles right now, probably most of you who are very close to me would have been affected by it. People from the third row onwards probably wouldn't have to worry about it. Okay, so it varies disease by disease by disease. Everybody with me? Okay? Now, if it happens to be, suppose I had Ebola, none of you would probably have gotten on it unless you decide when you suddenly saw me bleeding, you wanted to come and touch my blood and you happen to have a cut that way, or you decided to drink my blood for whatever reason, in that case you would be exposed to the Ebola virus. Okay, everybody with me? All right. Sexually transmitted diseases, none of you are likely to get be able to be in a position to get it or transfer it to a whole lot of people. It would be limited to sexual partners. By sexual partners, I include any close encounter, right, where bodily fluids could be exchanged, any bodily fluid could be exchanged. Everybody with me? Okay. That don't spread as fast as measles or anything like that. Now, so this one, this individual, you, therefore, are in contact with R0 other individuals. And let's say it's one of those diseases in which everybody you're in contact with will also get the disease. Again, tuberculosis and measles are really good examples. Virtually everybody gets it. Okay? That's why mumps, that's the other one that's coming back, virtually everybody would get it. All of these are airborne, and virtually every individual of, say, your grandparents' generation will have had that as a childhood disease. Why are they childhood diseases? Because since everybody gets it, you're likely to be exposed to it as a child, so you'll get it then. And since that builds up your immunity, you won't get it again. That's why these things are called childhood diseases. Everybody with me? All right? All right. So now here is the friend that you very happily infected, okay? And how many is he or she going to infect? Another R0. Okay? Everybody with me? All right. So if everybody is getting infected by you, that after generation and generations, the number of individuals will be R0 to the power of the N. Let's play with some numbers so you understand this better. So here's you. You have contact, relevant contact to only two other people, right? Over here. So here, R0 is equal to 2. Everybody with me? So one person has it now. After one generation, it's 2. Each of these infect 2 people. So after the second generation, there's 4. So you are going, you're starting out with one person. Sorry. Yeah, you're starting out with 2, which is R0 raised to the power of N. So it's just 0th generation starting out. 2 to the power of 0 is 1. The first level of infection, by generation I mean here not reproduction. By generation I mean the next disease cases. Generations of disease, not generations of the individuals. Everybody with me? This is just biological terminology. 2 to the 1 is 2. You're at this stage. 2 to the 2 is 4. You're at this stage. Next stage of infection, there'll be 8. Everybody with me? Okay. R0 to the power of N. All right. Now let's say that a certain fraction of the population happens to be immune. Okay. Now this happens to be immune, that fraction will include natural immunity as well as immunity generated through vaccination. Everybody with me? And by and large, when you have a disease that's likely to spread and cause epidemics and stuff like that, right, like measles right now, there isn't a whole lot of natural immunity. Okay. I've been trying to go back. There isn't very good statistics through generation. I've given up going back, actually. I tried to go back for a while, for a couple of months, to look up old records to see if there's any estimate of natural immunity to measles in human populations. The only populations for which I found some data that could be relevant are European populations, and there's virtually no evidence that there's a whole lot of natural immunity for it at all, right? And I'm harping on measles probably on and on and on, but partly because there really is an ongoing crisis right now. Yesterday, the number of measles cases reported and verified in the U.S. crossed the entire figure, the entire total for last year, for 2018. And ever since 2000, when measles was officially eliminated in the U.S., the only year that there have been more measles cases than there already have been this year is 2014. That's why I'm harping on it. This really is, it could easily become a public health disaster, right? Okay. And we are sitting in one of the epicenters of it, thanks to the anti-vaccination movement and Andrew Wakefield. I'm not neutral on this topic, as you can see. I'm neutral on virtually every other discussion that this class has had, most of which I'm genuinely neutral on, and some of which I've maintained neutrality, at least in class. This one I'm not neutral on, right? All right. Let's say that a fraction F is immune, okay, more or less due to vaccination. All right? Okay. That fraction is never going to be 100% if it's due to vaccination, because there's a certain period in life, roughly for, say, measles, the first 12 months, when it's too dangerous to give the vaccine. The immune education of a child after birth takes some time to get going. And right after a baby is born, it is accosted with so many different antigens that it has to keep up with that introducing a really dangerous one on top of that, right? Dangerous even in terms of just, not in terms of the disease developing, of generating lots and lots of secondary reactions is a dangerous one, so only a limited number of vaccines are given before age one. Everybody with me? And all of it. And that's what you should be thinking of when you're worrying about the anti-vaxxers. That it's not that they're putting a lot of other anti-vaxxers at risk, they're putting newborns at risk. That's what you need to be worried about as a public health issue. All right, so let's say the fraction F happens to be there, happens to be infected. So now when I infect you, right, there you are, you're infected, and you're in contact with R0, right, individuals. How many of them, on the average, are going to be infected? It's going to be R0 times the number of susceptible ones, right, or the fraction of susceptible ones. Everybody with me? Okay, if 70% are susceptible, then the chances are R0 much. So let's take a good example. Let's say half are susceptible, right? And you're in contact with two people. Then on the average, only one of them will get infected. Everybody with me? Okay. Half are susceptible, you're in contact with four people. Two of them will get infected. Everybody with me? Let's say 3/4 are susceptible. You're in contact with four people. On the average, three will get infected. Everybody with me? So if you think a bit, S must be equal to 1 minus F. The susceptible ones are the ones who are not immune. Fraction of immune plus fraction of susceptible must add up to 1. So the fraction of susceptible must be 1 minus the fraction of immune, so it's S is equal to 1 minus F. Everybody with me? All right? All right. So, after generation N, you'll have, by the same reasoning, so what you'll have then, after the first generation, is R0 times 1 minus F, so that's the expected number. Am I going too slowly? Or is this going to be okay? So, of cases, and let's stop calling them generations and call them cycles. That might help. Cycles of disease. So, after N cycles, right, you would have R0 to the power of N, 1 minus F to the power of N. All right? Everybody with me? Okay. Now, what you really want is if you want to contain right, an outbreak of a disease, you want that number to be less than one. Everybody with me? If that number is less than one and keeps on decreasing, it means that the disease will peter out in the population. Okay? All right. Let's see what that means as a piece of algebra. I always use the word algebra instead of mathematics because apparently it's less scary. Let's do this. R0 to the power of n, 1 minus, what do I have there? F, right? F to the power of n is less than 1, right? From this, only way I can do this is R0 itself times 1 minus F is less than 1. Okay? If you want to really impress people, you say you're taking the nth root of both sides, which is actually just a trivial piece of algebra, right? Because 1 to the power of n is equal to 1, you just get that. Everybody with me? Okay? So what do I get? R0 minus R0f is less than, there's a lot of different ways to do this. 1, right? So minus R0f is less than 1 minus R0. I've just taken this R0 from this side of the equation and put it on the other side. Everybody with me? Okay. I divide both sides by R0. I get minus f is less than 1 over R0 minus 1. Everybody with me? I'm dividing both sides by a positive number. And now if I multiply both sides by a minus sign, let's not do that. What I'm going to do is this. I'm going to take this F to the other side and bring all of this to this side, right? And I'll get F then is going to be greater than 1 minus 1 over R0. I'm going to stop for a minute to make sure everybody got the last step. There are a variety of ways of thinking about it. One of them is if you know your algebra, if you multiply both sides of an inequality, right, by a negative number, the inequality flips. That's the easiest way of saying it. Another way of saying it is, let's do it this way. I take f to the right-hand side. I have f then. I have the greater than sign. I take these to the other side. So I'm 1. The minus 1 becomes a 1 minus R0. I just rewrite this thing as that to make it look nicer. That is the central equation of vaccination epidemiology. And I kind of like it a lot because it satisfies what I like to call is the bartender's rule. Is that you've understood the science well enough only if you can explain it to your bartender at night. That satisfies the bartender's rule. God only knows how many bartenders in Austin have had to sit down and watch me do this on a napkin. Okay. Now let's do some calculations. Okay. And then I'll tell you, this is going to generate a couple of rather interesting, not projects, paper topics, which I will describe and start describing and putting up by the end of this week, right? Most of you, next week is the last day for choosing a paper, choosing to do your own paper topic. But these are the assigned topics. So one of them will be assigned. I'm going to ask you to do this, is the following. And here I am taking advantage of you. I was trying to do this for the last 20 minutes before I came to class and singularly failed to do it. which is what I was trying to do on the web, was to find out the fraction of the Austin population. Right. That happens to be, that is less than 1 year in age. Okay? All right? Because that's the fraction of the Austin population that clearly cannot be vaccinated. Everybody with me? Okay. Let's assume, because I have no other way of doing this, that this is 10%. In other words, F, the fraction can be, right, the fraction that can be vaccinated is going to be 1/9. Everybody with me? I'm going to play with that equation. So I have F must be greater than 1 minus 1 over R0. All right? So here I have 1/9 greater than 1 minus 1 over R0. Right? So let's take the 1 on this side. So I'll have 1/9 minus 1 is greater than 1 over R0. 1/9 minus 1 is minus 8/9 is greater than minus R over R0, right? I flip the... So let me first multiply, apply both. So let's have this in this way. I'm going to multiply both sides by minus and then by R0. So I'll have R0, 8 over 9 is greater than, less than 1, right? So R0 must be less than 9 over 8. In other words, right, even if you vaccinated everybody, right, okay, what you will then need is to make sure that people do not have contact with more than roughly one person in order to protect everybody. Everybody with me? And that's the kind of game you can play with this over and over again. Let's do another one. Let's say that you are in contact with 10 people to whom you can get the disease, right? So F then is greater than 1 minus 1 over 10. So F must be greater than 1 minus, so greater than 9/10. In other words, if you're in contact with 10 people to whom you can pass the disease, then you need a vaccination rate of 90% to prevent the disease from spreading. Everybody with me? That's the herd immunity calculation. This theory is called the theory of herd immunity. And the paper topic is going to be the following, okay? You are going to have to figure out the number of children, and if you really do a sophisticated way, the number of other people due to medical exemptions who cannot be vaccinated. Next, you need to find from the literature what the contagion rate, which is what R0 is called, is for a particular disease. Measles and stuff like that, right? And decide whether you can ever achieve herd immunity. That it might just be the case you cannot vaccinate enough people to ever get herd immunity. And then you worry about what to do, how close to it can you get, at what rate of vaccination. That's what you're likely to find. Everybody with me? Measles is so infectious that even if we vaccinated everybody, right, who can be vaccinated, we would not completely achieve herd immunity. That's how bad it is. So we better vaccinate everybody, because we would see, if we carry out this mathematics fully, that the slightest departure from full vaccination makes the outbreak into an epidemic where it just spreads without control. That's the problem of measles. All right, let's stop here and go over and make sure you understand this algebra, and we'll take it up from here on Thursday. Yeah?
What about the formula? What does F stand for again?
The fraction of individuals who are immune.
Okay, gotcha.
Which I'm saying is the same as the fraction of individuals who are vaccinated.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Just exchange with the person, right? 3 or 4 times. This is just the beginning.